Hello and welcome to this podcast from Don't Forget the Bubbles. This was recorded live at DFTB 19. If you enjoy this podcast, you can find all our back catalogue available on iTunes and Spotify. Enjoy!
The next speaker was a little disturbed by the title, Talk of Cataclysmic Change. When cataclysmic change is coming, I thought we should get Optimus Prime, but instead, we have the NHS Chief Transformation Officer, Helen Bevan.
Thanks, Ross. Thank you, Ross, and good afternoon. So, how did I get here? Well, a few months ago, Damien Rowland, who I used to regard as my friend, sent me an email and said, Helen, we're organising this fantastic conference. Don't forget the bubbles. And, you know, it'll be wonderful. Will you come and speak at it? And I said, yeah, of course I will. And I said, you know the kind of thing that I talk about. So, a few months after this, I get the programme. And it says on the programme that I'm giving a talk this afternoon on culture cataclysm and modern medicine. And I think, what the heck does that mean? I thought about it a little while, and I thought, you know what, it's really good to move beyond my comfort zone, so I'll have a go. So, esteemed colleagues, this afternoon I give my first ever talk on culture cataclysm and modern medicine. And depending on the reaction that I get from you, it might be my last or it might be the first of many. So, let's start off by dissecting this idea. Let's start off with culture. Okay. So, what do we mean by culture? So, I've defined it here, the patterns of widely shared assumptions, beliefs, and values that form the basis of people's ways of being, relating, and working. So, the kind of the invisible tentacles, that are around us that shape what we do. And underpinning that is the idea of mindsets, which is, the things in our heads, the conscious and unconscious understandings and expectations, the things that we hold to be true about ourselves and other people and the way we work, which in turn impacts on our behaviour, which is our observable action. And, just before I get to the cataclysm bit, what I'd say is I think that we are at the cusp of so much change in our system, in our services at the moment, which I think make the time culturally extremely confusing. So, a cataclysm. I use my snipping tool, to take this off the internet. And, a few different definitions of what cataclysm means, An occurrence inflicting widespread destruction and distress. Deluge, downpour. A lot of these are very negative. There's one in the middle that's less negative, so I can choose whatever definition I want. So I'm going for the one in the middle, A momentous or sweeping change, convulsion, revolution, upheaval. And I would agree that I think where we are currently in terms of the health and care system, we're in a cataclysmic moment of sweeping change. So I've kind of made the title relevant to what I'm going to say. Whew. I would say, when I look out where we are at the moment, I would say that there's so much tension in the system at the moment. We're on this kind of collision course between a world that is increasingly about connection, relationship, network, these kind of human-focused forces, and the system that we've traditionally been part of, which is very mechanistic and it's about, processes and functions. And, it's interesting listening to Taj talking about dystopia. Is the future dystopia? And again, when you think about cataclysmic, is it dystopian? Is it apocalyptic? And I'd say, well, it doesn't have to be. Most science fiction that we read looking into the future, most future scenarios are apocalyptic. But it doesn't have to be, and I think it's us. So, yes, cataclysmic change is happening, but I think we should be hopeful. Okay, only bit of theory I'm going to show you in the whole of my 18 minutes. Now, this is a model that I think is very helpful for thinking about, where we are now, the collision course, the tension, the cultural cataclysm. I think we are in a world where there is a massive tension going on between what I would call old power and new power. Old power is like a currency, it's like money. Some people have got a lot of it and most of us haven't. And it's about formal authority in organisations and systems. And the thing about old power is it's held by a few people. Those people with the senior roles, and it's pushed down in our organisations and systems. We get commanded to do things. You have to do that because it's the quality standard, or you've got to do that because it's the operating policy, or you've got to do that because we've got to balance the books at the end of the year. And the thing about old power is that it's closed, in the sense, if I'm a chief exec of an NHS organisation, and I go and do work with parents in the local community, I can't command those parents to do anything. Okay? And old power is largely about transactions and processes and functions and accountability and governance and so on. Okay? Let's contrast that with new power, which I think is an increasing force in the world. It's like a current, it's like a surge of energy. And new power happens and it grows because many people come together with a common purpose and common values. And the thing about new power is that we pull it in to our organisations and systems. And it's shared, it's open. The more people that want to engage with our new power movement, the more power we have. And the thing about new power is that it's about relationships. See, you know, what I'd say is one of the big differences is that we engage in new power because we want to. It fits with who we are in the world and the things that matter with us. Whereas with old power, you know, we have to do it, okay? It's, you know, it's the accountability system. It's the, you know, it's the process. And, new power is based on trust. So if I engage in a campaign or an initiative for change and I've got expectations that change is going to come as a result and it doesn't happen, I'm never going to engage with it again. So let's link that, you know, to cataclysm. So I think what we're seeing in our world is an increasing tension between old power and new power. And, you know, I am... In my job as the Chief Transformation Officer, I get to link up with and connect with loads of people like futurists and scenario planners and clever forward thinkers. Okay, a lot of them are predicting the imminent decline of old power. I don't think that old power will be dying in any health and care organisation I know anytime soon. But what we do see is this kind of layer of new power coming on the top that I think creates all kinds of possibilities. And, you know, those of us that are focused on change and improvement and taking things forward, I think we have to increasingly work in that very difficult, cataclysmic, zigzaggy place in the middle. This comes from Gary Hamel, and Gary Hamel, according to the Financial Times, is the number one business influencer in the world. And you know, what he talks about is, if we think about the kind of management systems that we're going to need in the future, okay, we need the kind of things that, in old power terms, help us to deliver high-quality, safe care to all the people that we serve and support. So, you know, we need conformance, we need consensus, we need cohesion. You know, if we want to you know, work beyond the unwarranted variation in our system, we need all those things. But they aren't enough, you know, to actually take things forward in a very fast-moving world. We also need diversity, we need dissent, we need divergence. And very often we're working in organisations and systems that I think value the latter rather than the former, okay? Hence the cataclysm. Okay, what I've got here is a chart that shows the tabulating machine company of 1917. And what you've got here is a well-structured organisation, you know, that people are doing jobs and they're all organised into divisions and directorates and departments. Okay? And actually, if you look at most of the health and care organisations that most of us work for, they look exactly the same as that, 102 years on. Now, in 1917, Okay, this made sense to the tabulating machine company because the kinds of work that people who worked for the tabulating machine company did was very repetitive, it wasn't very complex, it was highly predictable. When change happened, it was very slow, small scale and incremental. So it absolutely made sense in those times to organise people neatly into these little departments. But our world isn't like that. You know, our world is so fast moving. We have to create so many different relationships and connections between different parts of the organisation that these kinds of structures and ways of organising and thinking about change, they just don't work as well as they used to. So I'm not saying we don't need to have organisational structures and systems. We do. All I'm saying is, don't expect that big change is going to come through organising this way. And the problem, you know, when we try and work in top-down ways through structures like this, cascade change through our organisations, is that, first of all, it's a very slow way of doing change. And secondly, the whole basis of organising in this way is to reduce risk and is actually to stop change. So you know, it's not a very good mechanism trying to do things in top-down ways of making change happen. And increasingly, we're understanding that the people who are typically the most effective change agents in organisations aren't the people with the formal power who are you know, working in top-down ways. Actually, the most influential people who make and break change are the people who are the informal influencers who actually work in new power ways through connections and relationships. And over the last decade, we've seen a big growth in what's called organisation network analysis, where we're really starting to understand connections and influence in organisations. And what we see time and time again is that in organisations or systems, there are typically just 3% of people in organisations and systems who will drive conversations and lead change with 85% of other people. And, you know, these informal influencers can absolutely make or break our change processes. Because, you know, they're the people who have got the networks, the relationships, the contents, and they're driving the perceptions of other people in the organisation. So if there's some policy change or there's going to be a restructuring, then people in our organisations go and talk to the informal influencers. Because what they do, they're the go-to people for advice. And what they're also doing is they make meaning for people. They make sense of things. They reduce ambiguity. Okay, what the data shows us time and time again is that these informal influencers are typically more highly trusted by their peers than senior leaders or formal leaders are trusted. And these people are largely unknown to formal leaders. And so how do you find them? Well, you can bring in organisational network analysis data people and they'll come and do the analysis for you. Or you can just go around and ask people, okay? So, you know, just ask, you know, when you've got concerns at work, who do you go to for information? Or whose advice do you trust and respect? And you'll work them out really quickly. I'm doing a lot of work at the moment with ambulance services, with ambulance colleagues at the point of care, hundreds, thousands of them, of people across England. And one of the things that we've been looking at are who are the influencers? Who are these 3% super connectors? Here's one. This is Dave Morgan from Northeast Ambulance Service. And you know, how do we know that he's one of these 3%ers? If you just talk to other people, you know, he knows everyone in the ambulance service, not just in the Northeast. Okay? If you actually want some empirical data, go and look at his Twitter analytics, okay? Who he's talking to, who he's connecting with. And again, people say, you know, Dave, he helps you. He's always got advice, he helps you sort out issues, and he's really respected. Okay? So, you know, what I'd ask you is, who are your David Morgans? Okay? Who are your 3%? And what I'd also say is, you know, our senior leaders may actually be less influential than they think because, again, what the data shows us, if we want to get the same level of influence through top-down cascade through the organisation, okay, we need 4 times more people than if we work through the informal influencers. So, you know, what do we do? How do we move forward? The first thing is, can you be a superconnector? Okay? And you know, how do we do that? Well, it's relational. It's based on trust. It's based on authority. So build your own connections. You know, in terms of our own behaviours, actually be a model to other people of trust and positive behaviours. And because it's so much based on trust, you know, we need to be the peers and the leaders that always follow up with people. And if you can't be a super connector yourself, okay, find your super connectors. You know, find the people in your organisations who are highly influential. And then when you're involved in change or you're trying to make some things happen, get their insights, engage them in the change. And again, you know, new power is relational. So if we're going to make connections with our super connectors, it isn't just a short-term relationship where we want them to do something. You know, it's about engaging for the long haul. What's interesting, the data also shows us that the 3% rule doesn't just apply in organisations, it also seems to apply in social media. Okay? And what our analysis shows is that if you look at what's being retweeted, exactly the same ratio, 85% of the content that is retweeted comes from just 3% of people who tweet. I'm going to show you some social media and analytics now, and it looks a little bit overwhelming. Okay? So should we like just take a little breath? So, you ready for it? Okay, here we go. Okay, but I'm going to explain it. Okay. Yeah, so can you see up here on the left what looks like a big egg shape? This is a corporate organisation in the NHS, okay? And actually, if you looked at the corporate social media accounts of the organisations that you work for, it will probably be quite similar. What this is saying is, it's the pattern of interactions of a large corporate social media Twitter account in the NHS. And what you've got here is you've got an organisation whose corporate account has got like 250,000 followers. So you think, wow, you know, they're so powerful on social media. And yet, can you see there's only a very little ring around the outside? So there's a big, thick egg in the middle and a little ring around the outside. What that's telling us is that the big egg is because they're active on social media. You know, they're putting out, you know, so much content all the time, you know. They've got really great on-the-ball comms people that are putting the information out. But what's happening? It's hardly getting picked up by anybody, and it isn't being tweeted on. It's broadcast. It's one way. It's not very influential. What you've got here in the middle are what I would call the medical super connectors. Okay? They're mostly doctors, but they're not only doctors. And these are your 3% super connector equivalents. And anything that they tweet out, okay, it goes to other people, then more people, then more people. So they're hugely influential. And what's happening here is where the big corporate organisation doesn't tweets out itself, it doesn't go anywhere, but you see these green lines. If the super medical super connectors pick it up, then it flies. The trouble is that most corporate organisations don't understand this. Because if they did, what they do is rather than having an army of communications people tweeting out, they'd understand who their influencers were and they'd get their influencers to put their messages out for them because it would be far more effective. And, you know, I don't know if it makes me laugh or it makes me cry, but, you know, when you look at so many of our organisations in the NHS who have got such restrictive social media policies, okay, what we don't understand, our data shows that typically our employees have got 10 times more connections than our corporate social media accounts. So what we should be doing is empowering our staff to be the voice of our organisations. You know, they're the people that have got the audience. They've got the credibility. They're out there all the time being ambassadors for us, and they're behaving responsibly. And, you know, we can take this even further. This is interesting. This came from Nottingham University Hospitals, where the nurses on their nursing and midwifery board, they did a survey. And what they found was that those nurses who were active on Twitter, they called them Twitter-enabled, they were almost twice as likely to recall successes and information from organisational leaders than those that weren't on Twitter. So this is the way we need to be moving. And my very last slide. So in this world of cultural cataclysm, you know, we need to think about how do we bridge it. And I'd say we need to be the social leaders of the future. And that's about having the mindset and skills that, actually recognises, okay, that power and authority come much more from who you are in the world, how you behave and what you share, than on your reputation or simple positional authority. And I'll end there. Thank you.
Thank you very much indeed. So you are the hope for the future. Do we have any questions, Nikki?
We do. We have quite a few questions. No, it's quite, it's directed some debate on social media, but good debate. So Henry Goldstein, who is one of the organisers, quoted you saying, informal influencers are more trusted than formal leadership. Is it mistrust in the latter and why?
So I, you know, what I would say is that informal influencers will tend to be trusted more because I have a relationship with informal influencers. You know, I trust them in the world. I know what they're doing. They'll cover my back. They'll support me. And very often, I don't have the same relationship with a formal leader. And you know, being trusted, being regarded, is around behaviours and connections. So I'd say, you know, for formal leaders, actually, we need to learn from the informal leaders and build stronger relationships.
And then this kind of leads on to that. Thomas Fowles asked, is there power in getting an influencer to a formal leadership position, or do they lose their superpowers when promoted?
Oh, that's a great, it's a great question. So you know, what we, being a super connector and being well regarded is to do with a relationship. So if you've got a relationship and a connection with someone, you know, we'll tend to keep that. Regardless of a role. So, you know, some people say, well, the trouble is, once you start telling people they're super connectors, you know, they'll be less effective. But there's not actually any evidence to say that. So I think if we've got people that are really strong informal influencers who are going into formal leadership roles, I think that there's real advantages. Because I actually think also the whole way that formal leadership is going, mm-hmm. is formal leaders are having to work more and more in new power ways, in ways that are about, you know, relationships and connections and trusts and being kind. So, you know, it's a direction we should all be going in.
Not Game of Thrones, then?
No, definitely not Game of Thrones, no.
Last question from Keir Shields, who asked, how do junior doctors become part of the change as super connectors when they're only in a trust for 6 months at a time?
Yeah. You know, being a super connector is about building a relationship over a period of time. And if you're only in a place for a short period of time, I think that's difficult. But what I would say is, you know, as somebody who's in training, find out who the super connectors are. You know, find out amongst your colleagues who you can trust, who you can't, who's gonna support you. So I think it's very hard. You can't be a super connector if you don't build a relationship with somebody. But you can work through other super connectors, and you can be part of the movement and campaign for change. And you know, we'd want all doctors in training to be that.
That's fantastic. Thank you.
Okay. So do we have any last questions from the floor? We have a roving microphone. If you want to put your hand up. And one, so two questions.
I have two.
I've actually got a question for Taj.
Oh, good. Yay.
I agreed with your statement that the emergency departments can be the canary in the mine that identifies failures throughout the rest of the system. And my question is, how do you take that to advocate for change in the rest of the system rather than strengthening the emergency department systems?
Yeah, no, thank you. That's a great question. So I think that comes about through agreeing with policymakers and politicians what the standards that you set are for your system. And out of that, you then break that up and give people ownership around the Lego bricks that make up that common standard. So that's over the years really what we've tried to do. We're presently in discussions around the replacement for the four-hour standard, because that really became the tail wagging the dog. But really, you need a set of common standards. But once you then get the wider group together and say, how are we going to share that resource? So much of my last 3 years, with those of you who've been bored by me on the television, have been actually my three key messages to politicians and policymakers. Number one, invest in social care to keep people in the community. Number two, increase the acute bed base of the hospital, because our emergency admissions have risen by 35%, but you've cut the acute bed base by 12% in the last 6 years. And number three was address the staffing crisis that is affecting not just emergency departments, but the wider system. And it was in that order. So I want investment across the system, but you can only do that by agreeing a common set of standards.
Okay, and one last question here.
Thank you all for excellent talks. Jane Munro from Melbourne. Helen, so I've tried to start mapping the superconnectors at the Children's Hospital in Melbourne. And I want to know, if you bring superconnectors together, is that like the Justice League and you start ending up with is there actually a cumulative effect, or is that actually the opposite and it's a problem?
That's a really great question. I think it's really important to work through superconnectors, but in a sense, as a leader, you have to build your own relationship with superconnectors, because all this is based on trust and connection. So I think that it's a really good idea to, you know, when we're working through a change process, to engage and work with. You know, these people that are super connectors, but they're not necessarily, you know, they're like a hub in the middle of the system. You can see that from the social media analysis. They're not necessarily like a group who want to be organized with other super connectors. So I'd say, you know, understand that you know, these people are kind of hubs for connections with other people, and individually as influencers, it's really important to engage with people, but not necessarily organising them as a group of super connectors, because that's not how they work, I would say.
Thank you very much.
Hello, and welcome to this podcast from Don't Forget the Bubbles. This was recorded live at DFTB 19. If you enjoy this podcast, you can find all our back catalogue available on iTunes and Spotify. Enjoy!